Shalom and welcome. I am Richard Address, Director of Jewish Sacred Aging, and we welcome you to another in our series of Jewish Sacred Aging podcasts. These podcasts hope to feature conversations that relate to issues that touch on the impact of longevity within our community. And we welcome your thoughts, comments, and suggestions. You can email them to me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome to this podcast Rabbi Mark Katz to talk about his brand new book, a really beautiful book, The Heart of Loneliness, How Jewish Wisdom Can Help You Cope and Find Comfort. Mark, welcome. Welcome to podcasting Jewish Sacred Aging.
Thank you very much.
So this is, I will tell you point blank, I really enjoyed reading this book. It touched me in a variety of different ways. And it's a very, very personal book, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Talk to me a little bit about what motivated you to write this, because there's a lot in between the spaces and in between the lines. I sensed a lot of your own biography in here.
Well, it was interesting. I wrote the concept of the book actually as a sermon. I had been going through a divorce, and there's a point in every divorce where basically no one knows except for you in a very small circle. And I was walking around as the rabbi of, you know, of parts of my congregation. I was the assistant rabbi at the time, and, you know, carrying this burden with me. And no one knew what was going on except for me. And I somehow had to kind of perform or be there for people while at the same time being incredibly broken. And I understood fundamentally what loneliness meant in a way that I hadn't before. And so when the High Holidays came around and I was thinking of what I was going to speak about on Yom Kippur, I picked loneliness as a topic because I knew not only through my own experience, but through meeting other people and hearing other people's stories, just how profoundly lonely so many people are. And it comes in so many forms. It comes in 20s and 30s who have moved to a new place that don't have the shelter of college to help them meet friends. It comes in the form of people who are looking for love. It comes in the form of people who are dealing with divorce. It comes in the form of people who have just lost a loved one. It comes in the form of people who are growing older, and their social network might be dying around them, or they might be feeling like people are treating them differently because of their age. Every aspect of life is touched by this, and so I wanted to talk about that. So I did. And then eventually it turned into an Eli talk, which is kind of a Jewish TED talk. And then that turned into the book, and I went forward from there.
Well, you begin the book, in essence, the thesis statement right away on page 3, loneliness is the principal problem of human existence. Our yearning for companionship is part of the fabric of the universe, woven into being alongside the other miracles of God's hand. Unpack that for me, because it's, I mean, you stated it right away, right at the beginning of the book, loneliness is the principal problem of human existence. Talk to me about that.
Well, so loneliness was the first thing that went on in the universe. So, or went wrong in the universe, I mean. If you read the Bible, you find that God calls everything good. God creates the sun, calls it good, the moon, the stars, plants, animals, fish. Everything God calls tov, as God creates it, good. The first thing that God calls lo tov, or not good, is loneliness. God looks at Adam, totally alone, and says, lo tov heyot adam levado, it's not good that humanity or that a person should be lonely or should be alone. And from there, God creates Eve. There's a really interesting midrash, in fact, that God took Adam around to kind of name all of the animals.
Right.
And
great
as
midrash.
Adam saw each of these different animals, God realized that Adam didn't have a companion, you know. Two lions had companions, two sheep had companions, two dogs had companions, and Adam names each one. And then he turns to God and essentially says, but who's for me? And at that point, God realized God had erred. And so Adam was given this gift, this other human being. But the problem is that even with other people in our lives, that doesn't necessarily solve the problems of loneliness. In fact, proximity can only exacerbate the idea of loneliness. So we've all had that experience of being on a crowded train and feeling incredibly lonely because we're near all of these people who could potentially see us for who we are and care about us, but none of them do. And so it's this gnawing reality to living in this world, and loneliness pervades most aspects of our lives.
The word I teach this a lot too, and as part of the Jewish sacred aging stuff, but and you reflect upon it in the book. But this wonderful word from 218, and also from the Jacob Esau and Jacob to Israel portion of Livado. And talk to me a little bit about how you unpack this a little bit in the book, but it is such a profound concept of Livado. It's not just, it really isn't just alone. It really, I think Irving Yalom, the therapist, wrote a book on the death anxiety called Staring at the Sun. And he talks about existential aloneness, which I really think encompasses this idea of Livado. Talk to me about how you understand this word and how you teach it and how you preach it.
Yeah. So I actually wish I had come to this as I was writing the book, but I actually came to this definition of loneliness after, as I've been talking about the book.
Mm-hmm.
Livado, or loneliness, I see as the space between the person you think you are and the number of people who see you as that person. So I see myself as caring, as loving, as open, right? If I'm surrounded by a group of people who I perceive don't define me in the way that I see myself, that is the experience of being lonely. And the more people that can be in your life that can actually see you for you, the less likely you are to be plagued by this loneliness. And there are certain things that only exacerbate loneliness. So, for example, I talk in the book about shame and secrecy. Loneliness is incredibly dependent on both of those avenues. That if we have secrets, and if our secrets feed our shame, which is the feeling that we are less than worthy and that, in fact, we don't deserve the love of the people around us, then what's going to happen is we're going to see ourselves in our brokenness, and other people may not see us that way. And having that space between us in our brokenness and the way that we perceive other people relating to us is the engine that causes us to feel lonely.
Is the way out of that brokenness or that empty space tshuva?
I'm not sure. I mean, tshuva is an internal turning, right? And a returning to the person that you think that you are. Now, that I think is an important prerequisite to curing your loneliness. It's a good question, and I'm thinking out loud about this.
No, no, so that's the fun of just doing this a lot. I mean, you know, off the cuff, so... But it occurred to me while you were thinking that, I says, well, you know, if to fill that empty space that you're talking about, could that be a sense of tshuva, as a different, perhaps a different way of looking and defining that traditional term?
Yeah. So one of the things that I talk about in the book as I'm thinking about it is there's a number of ways to deal with your loneliness. And the book is intentionally called How to Cope with Your Loneliness, not How to Cure Your Loneliness, because the truth is loneliness is part of the human condition. It was there with Adam. It doesn't just disappear. There are times when you feel more lonely and when you feel less lonely in your life, but it's there and it's something that's going to plague everybody. But there are certain things you can put into place to help yourself. So, for example, reaching out for companionship, calling out from the depths of your pain to another person, asking them to see you for you, and then allowing them the space and the trust to respond to you in the way you need, that's incredibly important. But there are other things you can do as well. And here's where I think tshuva really comes into play, right? The idea is that, like, there's a lot of forgiveness that goes on when you are in the High Holy Day season, right, the season of tshuva. On the one hand, you need to forgive other people. So you need to trust other people to come to you when you call to them. And if they failed you in the past, you need to give them another shot to not fail you in the future. But part of the forgiveness of High Holy Days is also learning to forgive and love yourself again. I mean, every one of us is created B'Tselem Elohim, a God's image. There's a teaching that says that every one of us has a choir of angels processing before us, calling out, make way for the image of God, make way for the image of God. But too often, we don't treat ourselves well. And there's a fundamental difference between loneliness and solitude. Loneliness is this existential gnawing or yearning for companionship. Solitude just simply means being alone. But the two of them are connected, because if you're not good at being alone, then being alone causes loneliness. But if you learn to embrace what it means to be alone, then being alone doesn't become a threat and doesn't exacerbate your loneliness. So if you spend your life distracting yourself with telephones and the internet and applications and Facebook and Twitter, and you keep yourself busy so that you never actually have to face that voice inside of you, a voice that I once heard someone say that if you shut off the noise of the outside world and you start meditating, it's the equivalent of being trapped in a phone booth with a crazy person and a microphone. If you are like, if you don't cultivate that self-love, learn to forgive yourself, turn inward, not let your secrets and your shame gnaw away at you, then when you are alone, you're facing perhaps your worst enemy. But if you're able to learn to love yourself and embrace yourself, then time alone isn't threatening anymore, and it's not something that will lead you down the path toward loneliness.
So here's a question that popped up to me as I was reading the book, and I'd love to get your take on it. Are loneliness, the way you're understanding it, and love, Mark, two sides of the same coin?
I imagine so. Because you don't just seek out random people to help you. You seek out the people who are the closest in your life. And the distance that's created between you and someone that you love when they're not showing you the love that you need is one of the things that causes people to be incredibly lonely. Think about the idea that the more you love someone, often the more lonely you are after they die. Or the more you love someone, the more lonely you are after you break up with them. Or the more you love someone as you age, when they start treating you differently or ignoring you or seeing you as less than because of your age, the more that hurts. And so one of the problems is that in order to cure your loneliness, you have to open yourself up and be vulnerable. You have to allow other people to see you and allow yourself to love them and really to allow them to love you. But if you don't do that, right, then at least you stay safe and guarded and you don't have to give them the opening to hurt you. So the problem with actually dealing with loneliness is that you have to allow yourself to become incredibly raw to cope with it. But doing so can open you up for even more injury. And so I think that they're actually incredibly connected.
In the book, you talk about, I mean, you as you alluded to, you trace the idea of loneliness through a variety of different prisms, one of them which will resonate to to us, to clergy especially, is the loneliness of religious leadership. So I guess I have to ask you, you studied this, you looked at it, you wrote about it. Are clergy very lonely?
I think they can be. Yeah, I do. So as I mentioned, like the definition that I've been using lately for loneliness is the distance between the person that you perceive yourself to be and the people that are in your life and how they perceive you. And so if you think about it, the example that I use is Aaron, who's kind of the first clergy member. He's the high priest of ancient Israel while they're wandering in the desert. And there's a moment in time where the people come to Aaron, and they basically say to Aaron, build us a golden calf, meaning provide us with this conduit for religious connection. We don't feel God in our life. And they threaten him. And this is the rabbinic take on why Aaron builds the golden calf. They essentially say, we're willing to commit murder. If you don't listen to us and you don't build this calf for us, we will kill you. And Aaron realizes at that moment that what he has to do. And it's a metaphor, I think, for a lot of the way that religious leaders engage, right? being a rabbi is an incredibly busy job, and you don't always have time for connections, sometimes outside of your life. And sometimes you have to invest a lot of energy into the relationships that you have in the synagogue. But the only problem with that is that if people don't see you for you, they see you for your role, for example, connecting with them with God, facilitating their life cycle events, enabling them to learn more about Judaism, then they judge you based on what your role is religiously, not who you are. And these deep connections that supposedly exist, this is your Jewish community, fall apart. And you realize that people don't see you for you. You always have this mask of rabbi over your face. And in the book, I gave a bunch of different examples. One example that I gave was an elderly member of the faculty at Hebrew Union College, which is where I went to school. And I happened to be reading the Kaddish list, the list to remember people who had passed away.
Right, I remember that.
And there was a very important name on that list.
Very important. Right, very important. Yeah.
And I paused as I was reading the list. The list was in alphabetical order. So I got, I don't know if it was under M or W, if it's under Mayor or Wise, but I paused at a certain point. I looked up, I said the founder of our institution, and then I kept reading. So I magnified his name above the name of other people who had given a few hundred dollars here or there throughout the years. But this professor got really angry and told me that I had basically desecrated his memory. And it came to be, after talking to a number of people, I soon realized that the issue wasn't that he was upset at me. The issue was that in that moment, when I was reading the Kaddish list, I was not a representative of myself. I was a representative of Judaism and memory and Jewish time. And if someone didn't make a big deal about Isaac Meir Wise, then how much the more so would they not make a big deal after this professor passed away? And so suddenly, it didn't matter that I tried my hardest. It didn't matter that the rest of the service went really well. It didn't matter that I cared enough to pull that name and pause at it. The fact that I didn't make special mention of it, remove it from the alphabetical list, meant that Judaism may not care about him later on. And so in that moment, I was lonely because I was being yelled at for an unfair reason, something that I had signed up for but not really signed up for, which is to stand for a large idea like memory.
Mark, this whole concept of loneliness, and you talk a lot through the beginning of the book, especially about, you know, about 218, Genesis 2:18, and you mentioned the Midrash. One of the other questions that I wanted to ask you as I walk through the book, and it's sort of like channeled a little Heschel, is God lonely, Mark?
I think God is. Now, I don't have answers about the nature of God and who God is, and I wish I did. So a lot of belief is living out the question, if something were true, then what would it mean to me? And so I've been playing a lot recently with the idea that if God, in fact, was lonely, what would that mean to me? And I realized that when you look at Jewish tradition, God is incredibly lonely throughout every text, every period of time, and every commentary. You know, from the moment the world is created, God yearns from the companionship of Adam and Eve. And in fact, the Midrash explains that that's the reason God created them. But nevertheless, they fail. And each subsequent generation fails. And the closer God starts to feel, right, to human beings, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, eventually the Jewish people keep messing up. And so God, who's yearning for the companionship of humanity, ends up realizing that humans will never give God what God needs. Now, couple that with the idea of being a monotheistic being, right? Being the only God in the universe, and the task of God being like sui generi, like being one of a kind. And there's a very, very powerful story that I actually begin talking about God's loneliness with, which is the idea that the rabbis ask the question, why don't we really rejoice on Rosh Hashanah? You know, there are certain prayers you say that are like the big joy prayers, and we say them on Sukkot, we say them on Passover, we don't say them on Rosh Hashanah. And the answer that they give is that the angels during Rosh Hashanah started rejoicing. It was the new year, how exciting. And God silenced them. And God said, I'm sitting here with the book of life and the book of death open before me. And you're celebrating? How can you be joyous at a time like this? And at that point, it was mandated that Rosh Hashanah, although an important time of year, would not be as joyous as it possibly could be, because God is stressed out at that point. And so it's a great metaphor for what it means to be this kind of omnipotent solo being in the universe without another, without a companion. And every character in the Torah, I talk about a lot of them, can be emblematic of certain kinds of lonelinesses, right? Tamar, in my book, is emblematic of the loneliness of being single. Hagar, the loneliness of getting divorced. David, the loneliness of being kind of like the CEO, the king. Well, God is emblematic of another kind of loneliness, which is the loneliness of an incurable distance from those around them. And part of the advantage of reading these stories is to know that although you feel like your pain may be an island, it is not. That there are others who have tread the path before you, and that you're not the only one who feels this way about divorce or this way about being single. And God can serve as a model for that too. When you feel like you are the only one in the universe, when you feel that no one understands you, reading pain into God's experience can show you that even the chiefest among beings in the world feel loneliness as well.
So you talk about metaphor and symbolism and symbolic representation. You talk a little bit about Moses as a symbolic representation of aging. And could you walk us through that? Because it's... you know, people talk about Moses as a symbolic, you know, example of leadership, et cetera, but you sort of like weave this through one's own aging. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, Moses, if you think about it, did a lot in his life. He was incredibly successful and incredibly important. But his death, in a way, was one of the more tragic parts of the whole Bible. Moses doesn't want to die. Moses wants to keep leading the people. Moses is forced into retirement. And in fact, he pleads with the people to stand up for him. And according to the rabbis, according to Midrash, if the people had said, we want to enter the promised land with Moses, God probably would have let Moses in. But Moses is a voice in the ether. Moses is the only one pleading with God, asking that he can continue to lead the people. And the idea that Moses, after everything he's done, is only seen by his age and is treated as a non-entity once it's mandated that he's not going to enter into the land with the people is something that is, I think, a universal experience that many people who are older go through.
It's being played out every day.
Every day. I mean, I use this anecdote in my book, which is, I've been, visiting people in the hospital and watched as doctors and nurses come in, and I'm talking with my elderly congregant, and their kids are there. And the doctors and the nurses, although the congregant is completely capable of answering the questions of the doctors and nurses will address their questions to that person's adult children. And I see that actually in the way that the Jewish people relate to Moses at the end of Moses' life. That Moses, who actually had a great deal of vitality, there's a Midrash that says that, you know, Moses, when he went up to Mount Nebo to eventually die, basically skipped up the mountain as a man of 120. And that even the Bible itself talks about the vigor of his face didn't leave him. Like, just because someone grows older doesn't mean that they lose the kind of essential nature of who they are, and they also may not lose their usefulness. But we put things onto them, expectations, biases, that keep them at arm's distance. And as I mentioned, right, loneliness is caused by the space between the person you see yourself as and the way other people treat you. And so if everyone looks at you like you're old, but you still see yourself with value and something to offer the world around you, but no one will accept your gifts, how lonely is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the old Woody Allen line, I think, from Annie Hall or something, the third person invisible. And in my own dealings with older adults and situations like you're discussing, and also I watched it with my own mom, who is extremely alert and vital, but in the hospital, you know, until she really reamed out a doctor once, and because of exactly what you're talking about. You talk about, and before we start running out of time, I want to just press you on one other thing, because it's all, you alluded to it with your last story. The loneliness involved in illness, and you talk about this, and one of the early podcasts that we did on Jewish Sacred Aging with Elliot Dorf, which is archived on the website, but he also mentioned that one of the four major impacts of serious illness is this being of loneliness, of really being separated. So talk to me a little bit about coping with this loneliness of illness, and then you move in the book from illness into the whole concept of loss. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, each section of the book deals with one biblical character who's emblematic of that kind of loneliness. And the character that I used was a king whose name is Uzziah, a king that really doesn't appear very often in the Bible and is kind of buried, the story in the book of Chronicles, which they don't teach us this book in rabbinical school. I mean, this book is really a buried book. And Uzziah enters into kind of this holy chamber of the temple, despite the fact that everyone tells him not to. And because of his arrogance for entering in, he ends up getting what is known as Sarat, which is a scaly affliction on his forehead. And immediately the people rush him off and send him to kind of the tower. And from there, he basically is in solitary confinement because no one can cure this. And he ends up dying in this tower completely alone and completely isolated from everyone else. And in fact, he's buried outside of the city, not with the rest of the kings, but with the peasants because of this thing that he did. And all of this can be seen as kind of the isolation that's caused by growing sick. I mean, there's a very famous book. It's called Illness is a Metaphor by Susan Sontag. And one of the first lines in the book is that there are two kingdoms that we're all part of, the kingdom of the well and the kingdom of the ill. And what happens is that as we get sick, we end up migrating over to the other shore. But too often, this migration is a forced migration. And we end up looking on the other side, kind of dreaming about what our life would be like if we could stay on the kingdom of the well. And people don't see you for you. They often see you for your illness. I mean, how often has someone had cancer and the first thing that people see about them is not the essence of who they are, but the fact that they've lost their hair? Or you walk into a hospital and all you see is the tubes. My uncle had cancer, and it was a glioblastoma, brain cancer. And he ended up keeping his mental faculties for a very, very long time, but physically he fell apart. But my uncle would slur his words because his speech faculty was compromised. He couldn't really balance. He couldn't walk very well. And I began, and I think everyone in his life began to see him falling apart, not the fact that although he may have spoken slower or toward the end of his life, he could only really type out very slowly any kind of response, that he was all there. He was just kind of trapped in a body that was falling apart. And that experience, the essence of who you are, turn on you, is incredibly difficult. And something that both aging and illness have in common is the fact that one of the primary things that a lot of people who are aging and a lot of people who are sick want to be able to talk about and are not given the opening to talk about is the idea that they will die. It is so scary to think that you're going to die. But to have no one in your life talk to you about it because they feel so uncomfortable about it is actually an incredibly lonely experience, because you want to be able to share the things that are the most salient in your life. And for many people, death, imminent death, is the most salient thing in their life. But if they have literally no one to process it with, it remains bottled up. And as I said before, secrets are the things that kind of keep distance and make you feel lonely. And so if you're holding on to this fear of death, then that's only going to exacerbate that feeling of loneliness in your life.
And of course, you know, as we all know, death is the ultimate loneliness, and it is the great fear and probably the motivation for the birth of religion itself, to deal with this, the reality of this. And it's no coincidence that the Torah begins with the need to create antidotes to loneliness with other people. Rabbi Mark Katz, the book is The Heart of Loneliness, subtitled How Jewish Wisdom Can Help You Cope and Find Comfort. Mark, it's available where? Bookstores, Amazon?
It's available, I would say online is probably the best place to get it. It may be in a bookstore, but it's found on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, Target.com, those types of places.
Okay, the great God Amazon, you know, knows all. Anyway, again, The Heart of Loneliness, How Jewish Wisdom Can Help You Cope and Find Comfort. I really recommend for clergy, not only for clergy, but for individuals who've walked this walk or various aspects of this walk. You will find a tremendous wealth of information and a wonderful depth of feeling here from Mark that I think you will appreciate in a variety of different ways. So, Mark, thank you for writing this. Thank you for giving us your time here on the Jewish Sacred Aging podcast. And I wish you haslacha and continued success with this and everything in the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for listening to Jewish Sacred Aging podcast series, our podcast series. All of these podcasts are archived on our website, www.jewishsacredaging.com. And they're cross-posted on our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. Again, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Just drop me a note at rabbi@jewishsacredaging.com. We invite you to visit the website as well as, again, the site's Facebook page. We look forward to greeting you at our next session. And thank you for your support and attention. And a reminder that these podcasts are recorded through the facilities of Lubekin Media here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. To all of you, thank you. Tada and lehitraot.